Thank you. I'd like to welcome you all to today's lunch, where the guest speaker will be the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. I think we've had two really exciting sessions this morning with a lot of intellectual nourishment and a lot of really provocative and fascinating ideas to kick off the first stage of our conference. We appreciate very much that Malcolm Turnbull has joined us today. He's been a long-standing supporter of this conference, this Australian Newspaper and Melbourne Institute conference, and Mr. Turnbull has attended this conference in a number of different capacities over the years. He, of course, has been pretty preoccupied with national security issues over the last fortnight or so, and in particular over the last several days with a number of significant announcements. But we look forward to shifting the focus of the debate today back to the fundamental issues of economic policy, productivity, the budget, and global trade issues. The process for the lunch is that I'll introduce the Prime Minister, he will speak, and then the Prime Minister and I will be involved in a discussion here on the stage. So without further ado, I welcome Malcolm Turnbull to the podium.
Thanks, Paul. Well, thank you very much, Paul. And it is great to be back at the Melbourne Institute, the Australian Melbourne Institute conference. So I want to acknowledge Director Professor Abigail Payne, also the Ronald Henderson Professor from the Melbourne Institute. Paul Kelly has just introduced me. The partners, including the Productivity Commission. And Peter, I hear you've given a fantastic address earlier today. And of course, Glyn Davis, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne. The topic, New Directions in an Uncertain World, is a very timely one. We are living in a time where the pace and scale of change is utterly unprecedented throughout all of human history. At last week at the G20, I was proud to represent Australia as the largest economies of the world considered how to navigate the future under these conditions of rapid and indeed accelerating change. Economic progress, innovation, technology have advanced humanity and changed our lives for the better. The last two decades in particular have been characterised by disruption and change, much of it driven by the technology of the internet. Without the internet, of course, there would be no smartphone, no platform for what have now become the world's biggest companies. And we must not forget how rapid this change has been. The internet itself has really only been commercial, widely used by tens of millions of people for a little over 20 years. Facebook, with 2 billion accounts, started in a dorm room in Harvard in 2004. Most of these big internet companies, these giants, which are dominating the global economic landscape and in so many ways redefining the way we do business, the way we interact, the way we connect, would, if they were humans, still be at school, many of them, in fact, at primary school. So this is very, very rapid change. And so it's understandable that as businesses and citizens grapple with these changes, many Australians are uncertain about the future. They feel the threat of new competition weighing on their prospects for a new and better job, more hours, a rise in pay, and so forth. But as an article in Time magazine about technological unemployment reveals, this is not a new phenomenon. And I quote from that August journal, "The number of jobs lost to more efficient machines," they wrote, "is only part of the problem. What worries many job experts more is that automation may prevent the economy from creating enough new jobs." Now, the fact that those words were written in 1961 doesn't make this fear of the future any less real for Australians today. It is a thoroughly natural human reaction to the consequences of economic change. And yet, in Australia, we've seen the real benefits of economic progress. Over the last 20 years, average living standards have increased by 40%. 3.8 million additional jobs have been created, a 46% increase in employment. And nearly half of these new jobs were in the high-skilled categories. Many of them a product of the internet itself, including new categories of jobs that until recently did not exist at all. Now, today we all stand to benefit from the convenience of cheaper goods and services that have accompanied the innovation and technological progress of the last 20 years. And we can all benefit from increases in the quality of life and greater life expectancy brought about by new pharmaceuticals and medical procedures. So as we face the future, we have very good reason to be optimistic. Our economy is growing, we're recovering, and strongly from the inevitable waning of the mining investment boom. Many distinguished economists predicted a very hard landing, but the resilience of our economy and the flexibility and openness of our markets have proved them wrong. Only today, we see further growth in employment with now 240,000 additional jobs created over the last year, 175,000 of those full-time, and the participation rate increased to 65%, the highest since January 2016. Now, of course, sustained economic growth doesn't just happen. As John Howard said a decade ago, today's prosperity is the product of yesterday's reform. Tomorrow's prosperity can only be delivered by today's reform. So when we consider how we respond to the changing world in which we live, we can't hide under the doona and hope the big changes of our time will stop or go away. We have to harness the forces of change, make the best use of emerging technologies, and secure the jobs, the opportunities of the future. Our reforms in education, in energy, in infrastructure are designed to give Australians the tools and the skills to face uncertain times with confidence. And we're also giving Australians the incentives to invest in themselves and their businesses. Personal and business tax cuts, incentives for innovation investment, a regional jobs package that encourages people to have a go, a sovereign defence industry with all of the spillover benefits that will deliver for the whole economy, and trade deals that put Australians right at the heart of the global economy, right at the heart, at the height, at the forefront of the competition. Now, free trade and open markets have played a huge role in our 26 years of uninterrupted economic growth, and they're laying the groundwork for our future prosperity too. For much of our history, one or two industries have predominated. We rode on the sheep's back for a century. After Federation, manufacturing surged, peaking in the mid-60s. Service sectors became increasingly important in the latter half of last century. In the last couple of decades, mining has buoyed our economy, helping us weather the worst global financial collapse in 80 years. Today, our economy is more diverse than it has ever been, driven by our access to the big Asian markets, which our recent trade deals have deepened. Our growth comes from exporting not only commodities but services, agricultural products, high-quality food and wine to meet the evolving tastes of the rising Asian middle class. If any proof was needed that free trade and open markets are the keys to prosperity, Australia provides a perfect case in point. As I said at the G20 in Hangzhou last year and in Hamburg this year, we must never forget that protectionism is not a ladder to get you out of the low growth trap. It is a shovel to dig it much deeper. The more opportunities we can create for our businesses to succeed and reach new customers on the world stage, the more opportunities for other businesses to come and invest and partner with us, and then the stronger we will be. Now, in Hamburg last week, I secured strong commitments from G20 leaders on three potential future trade agreements. President Widodo, as you would have seen on the social media we did together, committed to concluding an Australia-Indonesia trade deal by the end of the year. That's great leadership on his part, sending a great message to the Indonesian system that he expects it to be concluded by the end of the year. Now, the leaders of the European Union also committed to securing an agreement with us, a free trade agreement between Australia and the EU, before Britain leaves the EU in 2019. And we are confident that we will, when Britain is free to do so, make a post-Brexit free trade agreement with the United Kingdom. So there's a lot of momentum, and we're taking our place on the global stage as both an exemplar and an advocate of free trade. Now, trade is already helping us plot a course in these uncharted waters, but the key to resilience in uncertain times is diversity. Agriculture and mining will always be important contributors to our economy, but we will never again be able to just ride the sheep's back, or the bulldozer for that matter, to prosperity. We can't put all of our economic eggs in the trade basket or in one particular industry basket. Diversity, resilience is the key. Optionality is the key. Making volatility your friend has to be the objective. You can't hide under the doona and pretend it's not happening. You can't deny the change is happening. You've got to say, how do we put ourselves, our nation, in the resilient posture to be able to take advantage of these opportunities? Now, in order to offer workers hope for the future and well-paid jobs, we have to allow new industries freely to develop. And so then consider what our future workforce needs to look like and reskill the current workforce accordingly. Our $220 million regional jobs and investment package is dedicated to supporting those new industries, their growth and development, so they can offer the diversity that will build resilience into the economy. Carbon Revolution in Geelong is a great example of a new industry that's breathing life into a community that had suffered big job losses. Much of the workforce comes from the Ford and Alcoa plants, and they're making the lightest carbon fibre wheel rims in the world. You may have seen in the election I was able to lift one up with one hand. I felt like I was some sort of super-powered figure for a moment. But in fact, it's a tribute to the brilliant technology of those Australians who have come out of the car industry for the most part, and there they are producing the best, lightest wheel rims in the world. Carbon technology is an vitally important frontier, and nowhere is it being better developed and advanced than in Australia. Australians can do anything. We have the skills, we've got to have the courage and the optimism to do it. And we are providing the support with our innovation and science agenda to encourage this stronger investment in venture capital and startups. I'm sure there's a few people from the startup and technology sector here, and they would confirm, I'm sure, that we're seeing record investments into the technology field, into the startup area. I was with one of the directors of the Australian Stock Exchange just a couple of days ago talking about the extraordinary growth in the tech sector on the ASX. I remember when we listed AussieMail 21 years ago now on the NASDAQ in 96, the reason we did was you simply could not have raised money for a technology company of any consequence on the Australian Stock Exchange in those days. Now, all of that has changed. And part of that is because of the leadership my government is providing, not simply providing the policy and the incentives and the tax breaks and the investments, but also proudly advocating the innovation agenda and talking up the ability of Australians to do anything. Optimism, confidence, taking advantage of volatility, not being frightened by it, is critically important. Now, we've already cut taxes for more than 3 million businesses that employ more than half of Australia's workforce. And we will go back to the Senate to seek support for the rest of our tax plan. Last week, I met leaders at the G20 from right across the political spectrum. On some issues, they had less in common, but on one thing they shared, you'll be interested to know, was a plan to reduce company tax rates. From the United States President Donald Trump, who wants to bring down company tax to 15%, to France's President Macron, who plans to cut his company tax rates to 25%, and of course in the UK, where since the Conservatives were elected in 2010, the corporate tax rate's been cut from 28% to 19% and will go to 17% by 2020. In the competition for jobs and investment, we cannot expect to be successful if our company tax rate remains at 30%. Now, this used to be a point of political consensus. Everyone knows that the more you tax investment, the less investment you get. But now this basic economic premise is a point of contention. The Labor Party opposition believes that the government is presumptively entitled to every dollar of a business's profit. They do. They say that a tax cut is a handout. So what that means is that they believe that every dollar a business makes in profit belongs to the government, and that anything that is left after tax, graciously by the government after tax, is a handout. Now, that is absurd. That is denying enterprise. It is discouraging investment. It's discouraging employment. Now, we believe that profits, as we all know, are the result of taking on challenges, taking risks, and succeeding in a competitive market. And we want to encourage more of this, not less. So the big difference when you compare the economic agenda of my government and our opponents is that you can see that every measure we have is focused on encouraging investment and employment. You no doubt, many of you will have recommendations as to how we can improve those measures, perhaps do more of some, less of others. But that's the focus of them. But the question you have to ask is, what is the Labor Party's, what are our opponents' policies that would support investment and employment? And there is literally none. It is all about higher taxes and higher debt. We need to ensure that in this increasingly competitive world, we are able to stay at the front of the game. We have to stay at the front of the pack, not fall off the back. And that's what would happen if we went down the road the Labor Party is proposing of higher taxes on business, less incentive to both to invest and to employ. Now, let me turn now to education. Equipping our children with the skills they need in the 21st century is a critical part of our ability to face the future with confidence. In the last sittings of the Parliament, we secured the biggest reform to school education in our nation's history. For the first time, all students, no matter their postcode or background, will benefit from record levels of needs-based funding that is fair, transparent, and nationally consistent. Needs-based funding has been talked about and indeed promised for years. No one really argues with it as a matter of principle. But our predecessors in government absolutely failed to deliver it. Instead, what we got from Labor, as you know, was 27 special deals that were not only inconsistent and unfair, that resulted in a school with the same needs in one part of the country getting dramatically different federal funding than one in another. There was no consistency at all. But not only did they have that failing, that flaw, if you like, but they were also unaffordable. And so what we've been able to do is not simply secure needs-based funding at record levels that is affordable, but we are now moving on to the key question, which is outcomes. how do we ensure that every single dollar of extra funding is used to lift grades and improve results? How can we ensure that our children have the skills for the dozen or more jobs that they are likely to have across their working lives? Great teachers in well-resourced schools is, of course, the place to start, but further work is needed. And that's why I've asked David Gonski and a panel of experts to investigate how that extra funding can best be spent to improve results, and that is the Gonski 2.0 agenda. This is designed to turn around our declining educational performance relative to other countries and prepare our students for a lifetime of opportunity, a time when, as I said, they will need to take advantage of the opportunities that arise in a rapidly changing world for the many jobs they are likely to have in that time, for the many opportunities that will arise. Now, turning to infrastructure, good infrastructure brings communities together, makes our regions and cities more livable, links businesses large and small with markets, widens the range of jobs and opportunities, makes housing more available and affordable. It's absolutely central. Now, we've increased the infrastructure investment to over $75 billion to get vital projects underway across the country. They include the largest freight rail infrastructure project in Australian history, the Melbourne to Brisbane Inland Rail, and the construction of the Western Sydney Airport. We're also building Snowy Hydro 2.0, which is a critical part of our plan to ensure secure and affordable energy. This will be the largest pumped hydro project in the Southern Hemisphere, a vital piece of infrastructure to make renewables reliable. Now, investment dollars are obviously the key part. You can't build any of this without money. But we need to take a smarter approach to planning, funding and building infrastructure. So reform is the only way to deliver the infrastructure that best serves our modern economy and makes the case and delivers an outcome where the Commonwealth is no longer just a passive ATM. So we need to have a say in where and how Commonwealth taxpayers' funds are invested and get the maximum benefits from every taxpayer dollar we invest. And so you've seen our City Deals agenda, where we will partner with state government and local government and other stakeholders, large stakeholders in particular, such as universities, Glyn, where we will be working together as partners, not just as a dollar out of grants, to co-invest wherever possible, ensuring that we have an economic interest that enables to make the Commonwealth dollar go further and to greater effect. Let me now turn to energy briefly. Critically, our continued economic progress depends on access to affordable and reliable energy, and we must achieve this while reducing our greenhouse gas emissions in accordance with our international commitments. Now, families and businesses need to know that they can get the power they need at an affordable price and reliably, whether it's from the grid, the microgrid in their own area, or their own solar panels on their own roof. And we have a record amount of that in Australia. Commercial facilities need a system that encourages competition through greater flexibility and the diversity of power sources, including cogeneration and distributed networks. Large industrial users, approaching 50% of demand, need reliable baseload power so they can sustain operations and have the confidence and certainty to invest. So our energy policies must therefore ensure affordability and reliability for all consumers. And as you've heard me say many times before, we can only achieve this through a mix of technologies. We've been prepared to take strong steps, decisive steps in this direction. I've talked about Snowy Hydro and be happy to do so further if you're interested, but that is a massive project. That will store 350,000 megawatt hours of electricity. You've heard about the battery in South Australia, and batteries have a very, very important role to play. I don't diminish it at all. But that battery will store 120 megawatt hours. So you can see the difference that you're talking about. Scale, is going to be absolutely critical in the modern energy economy. We're forcing energy companies to change their behaviour. We are now, as you know, we are now going to impose restrictions on the export of gas from the East Coast market. We do so with great reluctance, but the reality is that previous governments allowed a large export market to facilities to be developed without paying any regard to the consequences for domestic supply. It's an extraordinary negligence, complacency that saw that happen, and we cannot be in a position where Australia, about to become the largest exporter of LNG in the world, literally has a shortage of gas in its domestic market on the East Coast. We've taken steps to ensure that the network companies can no longer use the courts to overturn regulators' decisions on what they can charge for poles and wires. We're taking steps to ensure that pipeline operators develop modern secondary markets to increase supply and lower prices. And, of course, we're ensuring the ACCC is going to give greater transparency or full transparency to the pricing behaviour of electricity retailers. We are taking every step we can to ensure that energy in Australia is affordable and reliable. There has been a huge amount of mistakes made in the past. Many of them have been the result of politics. Many of them, like the decision about gas exports, I think have been the result of negligence or an absence of mind. But step by step, we are fixing these issues. And our approach is guided by engineering and economics, not ideology and politics, with an unrelenting focus on the needs of consumers and a system that will deliver affordable and reliable energy. Now, the pace and scale of the change that's transforming the world does create uncertainty, as we know. It also improves our lives. Managing uncertainty is and always has been part of life. Households and businesses grapple with it daily. When you buy a new home, invest in new equipment, enter a new market. Now, I don't view uncertainty with the same pessimism that some others do. But the topic of this conference reminds us that economic disruption and change requires a response. Doing things as they've always been done is not the answer. As I've said earlier in this week, in the context of our changes to our security apparatus, set and forget is never an option. My approach in every single area of policy is to every day seek to optimise and improve what we do. Don't wait for failure or a crisis. Make sure that you are constantly improving what you're doing. That way you stay ahead of the challenges, you stay ahead of the threats, and you ensure that we are best poised to achieve our goals and realise our opportunities. So at the heart of our efforts is the principle, deep in our DNA, that the government's role is to enable Australians to do their best, to realise their dreams, to broaden their horizons as they see fit, not, as our opponents in the Labor Party would have it, as government decrees. There is the fundamental difference. We are committed to freedom. We respect individuals as individuals, their freedom to determine their own lives, and everything we do is designed to enable them to do that and do that more successfully. We do not believe that government knows best. So I believe that in a world of change unprecedented in its pace and scale, because of our commitment to freedom, because of our determination to be innovative, to be optimistic, to be confident, because of that Australian spirit, no nation is better able to meet the challenges and seize the opportunities of our age than our own Australia. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Prime Minister. You're an optimist, and that was an optimistic speech. We know in an age of disruption and great technological change that jobs are being destroyed and new jobs are being created. It's one of the arguments you just made. But there's a lot of analysis which suggests that in terms of the new jobs being created, they tend to fall, in simplified terms, into two categories. Quality jobs at the high end that are well paid, and other jobs that are low paid jobs, perhaps in the services sector, perhaps casual employment. To what extent are you concerned that we might see this problem emerging as a significant challenge for Australia? And if so, what can you do to bring people with you, people who are concerned about insecurity, job insecurity, but beyond that, concerned that they're not going to be prospering as much in the future as they did in the past because of these changes in the labour market?
Well, thanks, Paul. Obviously, seeing is believing, and that is why we have to resist the populism, for example, of protectionism. That is, as I think Peter was saying earlier today, that would pose a very real risk to Australia. We need to ensure that we open up as many opportunities for Australians and Australian businesses as we can. A very good example is Tasmania. Tasmania is enjoying stronger economic growth than it has had for many, many years. And it is being driven by those big trade deals, in particular the Australia-China Free Trade Agreement. It is being driven by the greater opportunities that are being opened up. In any time of rapid change, there will be, obviously, challenges and opportunities, plainly. But what you have to do is ensure that you have the resilience and the agility and the confidence to seize those opportunities. I know, you know, some people suggest, I've sort of gathered a slight note of chastisement in your introduction a moment ago. Some people suggest that I'm too optimistic. Let me tell you, you don't want a Prime Minister who's a pessimist. You want somebody who believes Australians can do anything and does everything he can to ensure that they do. That's my commitment.
Okay, now let me just take you up on that. You're an optimist and you're very persuasive when you make these arguments, but how do you carry the Australian public behind this? How do you persuade the Australian public that they should be optimists as well?
Well, because you, with the results, I mean, that's what you need. We're seeing, you know, I've said elsewhere, and I know Scott will, in his address to this conference later, will make the same point. Jobs and growth is not just a slogan, it's an outcome. We are seeing continued strong jobs growth, you know, high participation, highest since January last year. We're seeing continued strong employment growth. Wage growth, particularly real wage growth, is still lower than we would like. It's a low inflation environment. That is a global problem. But we shouldn't kid ourselves that the answer to that is throwing up trade barriers and trying to pretend that all of this technological change is not occurring.
Well, let's just go to this question of trade. You've come back from the G20 meeting.
Yep.
How significant were the divisions in the room among those heads of government about trade policy?
Not nearly as significant as obviously was portrayed in some of the media, although I hesitate to criticise the media here.
The differences were quite marked, though, Prime Minister, surely.
The difference is really between the approach of the new American administration, President Trump's administration, and other countries. By and large, the commitment to continued commitment to free trade and open markets is very strong. And I mean, even from the American point of view, I'd have to say that, you know, President Trump is a businessman. He's been in business globally all his life. He comes to the White House with an unprecedented length of experience in business. And so what he is seeking to do, I would characterise the new US administration's approach as not being anti-trade, as many people have done, but rather seeking to ensure that trade is, from their point of view, fairer on a more level playing field and so forth. And hence, you know, there was a lot of discussion and I think a high degree of consensus on issues like oversupply and, you know, what we would call dumping in the steel market. So that's a, you know, that's an example. So again, I think the difference between, say, President Trump and other leaders, or indeed his predecessor, is more one of emphasis than it is of principle. I don't think, you know, we're not heading back to the Smoot-Hawley Act or something like that, you know, which was the, you know, when the US threw up huge trade barriers in the Depression.
So you don't think, I mean, you don't rate highly from those comments the risk of a global trade disruption?
Well, no, I think there's a, I think there is, there are two questions. Do I think there will be massive global trade disruption of the kind that some more pessimistic scenarios would suggest? No, I don't think there will be, because I think self-interest, good sense will prevail. But would we be big losers from a rise in protectionism globally? Absolutely, we would be. I mean, whatever you may think of protectionist agendas in other markets, believe me, from our point of view, Australia's massive vested interest is in free trade. We are a trading nation, and you can see the benefits of a more diversified economy, and you see this particularly in regional Australia, where obviously there were some very heavy blows as the mining construction boom wound down, as it was always going to. But a lot of one of the reasons that landing was less hard than it otherwise might have been is because of the opportunities that have come from trade, particularly into Asia.
Now, we saw the reports about assurances you got when you were overseas in relation to steel and aluminium from Australia. What's the nature of those assurances?
Well, I'm not going to go into the specifics, but what I can say is that we've been discussing the issue with the US administration over recent months. We've had good discussions with, I've had good discussions with the President directly, and also I was there at the G20 with Matthias Cormann, Finance Minister, and we've discussed it with Gary Cohen, the Economic Advisor, Steve Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, obviously the Secretary for Trade in the US government, and Steve Chobo, our Trade Minister, has also had regular discussions with the US counterparts since this review they've made on steel was first initiated. The discussions continue to highlight that the US-Australia relationship is very strong, and we are confident that our steel exports to the US pose no risk to US national security and, in fact, bring substantial economic benefits to both our countries. And I have, appropriately, my last discussions with President Trump on this matter were held in a steel box, I should say, which was the SCIF, the Secure Communications Information Facility, which is like a steel box or room that we had this discussion with about seven or eight of us in there, and we've been, I can assure you, Australia's interests, and in particular in this context of our steel industry, have been very strongly advocated, and we've had a very good reception, but we obviously will wait and see what the administration finally decides when it announces the consequences or the outcomes of the review.
Now, we're about to see some significant changes in global monetary policy. The US Fed has made clear its intentions, and while the cash rate in this country never got as low as the cash rate in other in other nations, nonetheless, our central bank will be part of these adjustments. Given the extent of household debt in this country. To what extent are you concerned that the monetary policy adjustment, when it comes in this country, will pose certain risks because we are vulnerable in terms of household debt? How concerned are you about this?
Well, the answer is I'm always concerned about that. Neil Mitchell was asking me about this morning on the radio here in Melbourne, and I think, and this is particularly in the light of the Reserve Bank's comments in their recent statement about monetary policy. Look, rates. What they're saying to us is rates are more likely to go up than down. Clearly, they're saying that the neutral real interest rate they think is about 1%. If you assume that inflation is 2.5, then that would indicate a nominal cash rate of 3.5. Now, but what they're not saying is that they're going to increase the cash rate to 3.5%, you know, next month. Quite the contrary. So the monetary policy at the moment remains accommodative. The bank is indicating it's likely to remain that way for a while yet, but rates are more likely to go up than down. So what does that mean? It means households in particular and businesses need to bear that in mind. Clearly, you need to remember that asset price movements go in two directions. And particularly this is relevant to housing. I know it's been a pretty good one-way bet for a long time, but it's going to be important for people to be prudent. So now the banks are clearly very alert to that. You've seen changes in lending policy. You've seen changes, and particularly in the rates, increases in the rates they apply to interest-only loans and the availability of interest-only loans. So my sense is that this risk is being well managed, but it is high levels of indebtedness that are incurred with low levels of interest rates always pose a risk when you've got the prospect of an increase in rates, particularly if it's been all built on an assumption of rising asset prices.
Now, if we just switch to taxation, from what you just said in your speech with your commitment to proceed with the corporate tax cuts, which have not yet passed the Senate,
yep.
When will you reintroduce that legislation?
Shortly. That'll all be introduced. It'll be debated in the Senate before the year's end.
Okay. What about personal income tax? The Liberal Party, of course, traditionally stands for cutting personal income tax when it can. To what extent do you aspire over the course of the current Parliament or going into the next election to be able to bring forward commitments in that area?
Well, our view is that tax should be lower. You have to raise tax to pay the bills, but clearly all taxes have an economic cost, particularly business taxes. There is a dead weight loss associated with every tax, as all the economists here know better than me. The issue is affordability. Now, what we have done is we increased last year, as you know, the threshold, the 80,000 threshold to 87,000, so about 500,000 Australians over the next few years will not go into the second highest tax bracket, so that was a valuable middle income tax cut. We did not extend, despite a lot of pressure, the deficit levy, which added 2% to the top marginal rate. Mr. Shorten, obviously, when Tony Abbott introduced this in the 2014 budget, Shorten described this as a deceit levy and denounced it, and then finally voted for it on the basis that it had a three-year term. So we haven't removed it, we've allowed it to expire in accordance with the terms it was agreed on. We've been criticised for that, but that obviously gives you an indication that we feel already our personal tax rates are high and our top marginal rate is high, by global standards, and in addition, the threshold at which it comes in, which is a two and a half times average full-time earnings, is a low threshold for a top marginal rate, again, compared to other countries. Well, so we shouldn't kid ourselves. We are a highly taxed country, both in terms of company tax and personal income tax.
Well, we certainly are, and I noticed that was a pretty cautious and measured response. We had a discussion on tax this morning, in particular led by Bob Gregory.
Yeah.
And one of the takeouts from that is that according to the government's own budget papers, if you look at the pathway back to surplus, this will be achieved overwhelmingly through increases in personal income tax, in particular through fiscal drag. And that in this sense, of course, it represents a choice made by your government. That is an overwhelming choice to address the budget deficit problem on the personal income tax side. What's your response to that analysis?
Well, I'll make a couple of points, and Scott will elaborate on this later on in his address. But average real growth in spending under this government, our government, is lower than the average of each of the previous five governments, extending back almost 50 years. Spending is expected to come down to 25% of GDP over the forward estimates. Beyond that, the contribution of higher revenue to budget repair is a matter of arithmetic. The less we can achieve in terms of reductions in spending, the more obstruction in the Senate delays the return to surplus, the more heavy lifting that revenue has to do. And you've seen, you know, the imposition of the major bank levy is an example of the response we had to make. That gave us no joy to raise that revenue, but that was how we needed to get the budget back into surplus, and we are doing that. Now, it's worth pointing out, however, that the budget numbers, the medium-term numbers, over 10 years, assume that tax is capped as a share of GDP. That's just a mechanical assumption. So put another way, the numbers factor in addressing bracket creep. So I just, you know, 10-year numbers have all of the limitations of forecasts that far out, or invariably do. But there is a cap on the percentage of tax as a share of GDP.
But Prime Minister, the Treasurer has said for most of the past 18 months that the government's priority would be to address the fiscal issue, to address the budget problem on the spending side, and that manifestly has not happened. It's been overwhelming.
It's not happened as much as we would have liked, but we have made, it's actually in excess now of $25 billion of savings on the spending side. So we've got a lot more through the Senate than we anticipated. It's certainly vastly more than many of our commentators and observers anticipated. I can't tell you how many press conferences I've been at when I've been urged to admit that I had no prospect of getting a particular measure through the Senate, and you know, I've refused to do so, and turned out we've been able to get things done.
Okay, so. but just on that point, if you're saying that you've actually been pretty effective in managing the Senate, this raises the question as to whether or not your decision to address the budget issue on the tax side rather than the spending side is your own choice rather than an option that's been forced upon you by the Senate and by the political system. So what is it? Is it your choice or is it the choice that's been imposed upon you?
Well, the choices that we've got to make are constrained by political reality. We have had a number of savings measures that we could not get passage of through the Senate. I mean, some people, many of them had their origins in the 2014 budget. They were often unkindly referred to as zombies because they remained extant for a long time. But we've dealt with all of that. The budget is the budget that we brought down, or Scott brought down, this year is a very realistic budget. It's got some important saving. It's got some important new revenue measures in it, which we have been obliged to undertake in order to ensure that we can meet our obligations and that we can bring the budget back into balance. Now, you know, we have to deal with the Senate, the Australian people elected. And I know, you know, the reality is the Australian Senate has the same powers for all intents and purposes as the House, and we've got to play the hand of cards we're dealt. And so my job as Prime Minister is to govern. My job is to deliver and to do everything I can to make the Parliament work. There is no point in, you know, pretending that measures, you can get measures through the Senate if you can't. You've got to do everything you can to get them through. We've done a lot better than many forecast. We look forward to working with the crossbench, whom we respect and we cooperate with. We'll do everything we can to ensure that we can, working with the Senate, deliver the best outcomes for the Australian people. But you can't, you know, you can't deal with a Senate in which you have 29 votes out of 76 by way of ultimatum.
Sure.
You've got to negotiate.
Sure. Now, you talked about delivery, and delivery is clearly going to be critical when it comes to energy policy.
Yep.
When the Finkel report was released, you said you were very favorably disposed towards it. Can I just ask you now, what are your aspirations in terms of the critical final recommendation of the Finkel report for a clean energy target? Is this your aspiration to get up this target? And to what extent, given the commitment the general comments you've made about coal in recent times, particularly last weekend, how do you factor that commitment to coal into this response to Finkel?
Okay. Well, we're doing more analysis and getting more analysis done on the clean energy target. We've asked the Australian Energy Market Operator, AEMO, to give us some advice on what the gap is going to be in terms of reliable dispatchable power, you know, base load power, if you like, over the next 5 and 10 years. We don't want to have any more shocks as we had after the closure of Hazelwood. So we've got to make sure that as older coal-fired power plants close, and you know, eventually they will, we've got to make sure that we have the base load to replace that. My attitude to technology is absolutely agnostic. The proposition that coal has no role to play is utterly unrealistic and in defiance of all of the expert analysis and the facts. And I, those, you know, I'm a great, you know, enthusiast, as you all know. You've just heard me talk about Snowy Hydro. I'm a great enthusiast for renewable technologies and technologies generally. The cost of renewable energy, electricity generation is coming down all the time, particularly photovoltaic, solar photovoltaic. It's been actually quite remarkable. But you've got to be able to deliver base load power as well. Now, the object of energy policy should not be to build, you know, to have a certain percentage of renewables. The object should be secure and affordable power, and the emission reduction objective should be to reduce emissions. A very good leading article in The Economist, if I can dare mention a competitor here, which makes that very point, that you can't allow yourself to miss the point. If your object is to reduce emissions, if that is an object of policy, and clearly that is part of it, then there are many roads to do that, and having a high efficiency, low emission coal-fired power sector is clearly consistent with that. But again, we'll await further analysis and review, in particular from AEMO, on that.
Well,
I can
I think
assure
there
you, engineering and economics has got to be the guide to this,
okay,
not
well,
ideology.
I think there are two quick questions that we'll finish up on
Yep.
In relation to that answer. So, yes, you've taken up the point made by The Economist, which is a point The Australian has made in the past as well. That is,
Yep.
the objective is about emissions reduction. It's not particular renewable energy targets. But
Yep.
we have a renewable energy target.
We do.
Which seems to be sitting in contradiction with the principle you just enunciated. So how do we reconcile that?
Well, the target is there. It's legislated. It was recently amended. It will be completed by 2020. We are committed to it. The last thing you need is more uncertainty in that market. You know, you add uncertainty to that renewable sector, and all that would happen is that the cost on consumers would go up. You know, because cost of the default price, people would start paying the default price of the renewable energy certificate.
Well, let me ask you.
So if I could just make this final point. The object of the renewable energy targets, whether it was the MRET under the Howard government or its successors, was actually to encourage, in every country, to encourage investment in renewables to produce a sort of pull-through effect on the technology. Now, whether that's worked or not is another question, but the one thing we do know is that renewables have become much more prolific and the cost has come down dramatically. The technological advance has been extraordinary. Whether that would have happened in the absence of those subsidies is another question.
Okay, and the final question, PM. In relation to coal, will you let the market decide this issue, or will you lean towards the position taken by some of your colleagues, such as your Deputy Prime Minister, for example, who's made it clear that he would like to see emerging from this process the commitment to a new a clean energy coal-fired power station and, if necessary, with government financial support?
Well, the outcome, well, clearly it's always better if the market delivers all of these solutions. The government is involved, obviously, with Snowy Hydro, but that is a government-owned entity and will always be so. But if I could just make this point, the object is to ensure that Australians have reliable, affordable energy. The technology that is used to get there is, you know, should be judged on its merits. If you look at South Australia, for example, as a classic case in point, people, you can say their mistake was to have so many wind farms. Well, that's a point that many have made. The real mistake was to have such a huge dependence on wind farms, an intermittent source of energy, allow baseload to be closed and provide no backup for it. So if they had had lots of wind farms and lots of storage, it would have resulted in a satisfactory outcome instead of this enormous dependency on the big extension cord to the state of Victoria.
Now, you just said that technology should be decided on merit. I mean, one could interpret that to mean that you will let the market decide.
Well, of course the market...
The question is whether the government intervenes and decides as a matter of policy in its own right it wants to see a new coal-fired power station or not, which is not letting the market decide, that's letting the government decide.
Well, there is an important role for government in energy policy, obviously, but the goal should always be for investment decisions to be made by the market, by participants in the market, on economic grounds. There are opportunities for support you have the Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund for infrastructure in Northern Australia, you have the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, but the aim has got to be, I think, always to ensure that you get the best outcome for consumers, so, and markets deliver that, and in this case we're talking about affordable and reliable energy, and each of those criteria have been put at risk by poor policy making in recent years, and by just as I've made the point about gas exports, by the sheer absence of mind, the complacency, the failure for either the Labor federal government or Labor state government to say, hang on, if we allow all of this gas to be exported, what is that going to mean for the domestic market? Now, the fact that I've had to take some pretty heavy-handed intervention there gives me no joy at all, quite the contrary. But the alternative is having a, you know, gas shortage on the East Coast that will put tens of thousands of people out of work. So, you know, what we're... That's why I say the focus of energy policy or the drivers of energy policy have got to be engineering and economics. You know, the one-liners and ideology and slogans and all of that stuff, you know, that can be fine, you know, at a rally or something like that. But in terms of actually designing the measures that will deliver what Australian families want, which is affordable, reliable energy and meet our international commitments, you've got to be guided by engineering and economics, and that, of course, requires analysis, requires the work that AEMO is undertaking. We've got to make sure that we improve the quality of our policy making in the energy sector. And I have to say, Josh Frydenberg is doing a fantastic job as the Energy Minister, as is Matt Canavan, as the Resources Minister, and my government is determined to do everything we can not to remake the mistakes of the past, but instead to set us on a course of affordable, reliable energy and, of course, meet those emissions reduction commitments that we've made.
Prime Minister, I want to thank you very much for giving so much of your time to this conference, this Australian Newspaper Melbourne Institute conference. We appreciate so much that you've come, that you've addressed us, and in particular that you've made yourself available for this discussion. And I'd like to thank you very much for the very frank way you've conducted this conversation in terms of responding to these issues. I know the audience would appreciate it very much. Thank you. And we should thank the Prime Minister in the usual way.
Thank you.